Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
This is disgraceful.
Hi, welcome to another episode of the Political Football, a podcast series from These Football Times. Football is a global phenomenon. People who follow it can fall into an obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national or club team can define their lives, attitudes and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time and in so many places around the world, though, the games to intoxicate and elicit unquestioned devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties, other political organisations, or even individuals seeking a way to persuade, influence and increase power by using football as a tool. This series looks at examples of such scenarios, consider their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces, and also questions whether, at times, football has kicked back or provides a means to counter them. This is the Political Football, and today we're going to discuss football and its relationship to populist politics. It's a subject that's bang up to date with the general election in the UK going on at the moment, so we'll be discussing something that's really of contemporary interest. I'm Gary Thacker, and I'm delighted that my good friend Stu Horsfield is co-hosting with me on this series. How you doing, Stu?
Hi, Gary. Yeah, good, thank you. As always, looking forward to this. As you mentioned, the subject is right up my street. It's right in the sweet spot of where my interest lies in football, contemporary social issues, current topics, impact on the game, and how the game impacts on the populist politics. It's like I say, really, really looking forward to this. Obviously, no pressure on the guest.
it's great that the world of politics has sort of aligned itself to be bang up to date with our series and the particular episode today. So who's our guest, buddy?
So today's guest is Matthew Gibbs. Matthew, 26-year-old journalist from Birmingham, currently living and working in Madrid. Oh, so nice. Mostly working as a school teacher. Also does bits of writing, obviously, mostly for us at These Football Times, as well as the German football website, Get German Football News. Passionate about sport and increasingly fascinated by its intrinsic and inseparable relationship with politics. So obviously it's why he's here today and will be the perfect guest. Again, no pressure.
Hi, good evening, both.
Hi, Matthew, you all right?
Not too bad, thanks. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Like I say, I hopefully not put too much pressure on you, but really looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's quite a heavy subject to be getting into.
Oh, we're good at that.
I mean, that's what we're here for. It's nice to have a fellow Spanish resident on the podcast with me, because normally I'm the guy from here, and people are from England, so, you know, Boris Notches.
<Very much. laughs>
So just to kick us off, give us a little bit of a context of how you see populist politics and football intermingling.
So I think over the last year especially, we've seen racism, homophobia and bigotry of all kinds increasingly raising their heads. And it's been mingling with hooliganism, violence and intolerance. And I think one of the main reasons for this can be linked to the political situation across Europe, which has seen, as you mentioned, populism and far-right politics sort of inexplicably rise across the continent. And I really, truly hate to say it, but I think we're going to be talking a bit about Brexit as well.
Oh no.
Holy moly. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we will. And, you know, and let's face it, Brexit is a massive issue with regards to populist politics. So can you give us a couple of examples of the what you're referring to, Matthew, across Europe?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I think there are quite a few examples. So in Italy, we've seen racist incidents against black footballers skyrocket, with Moise Kean when he was there, Romelu Lukaku and Kalidou Koulibaly, all subjected to horrific and senseless discrimination. And there's been some ugly incidents of anti-Semitism. In France, there were games marred by homophobic chanting, which led to quite a few matches being halted. In Greece, there were incredibly violent riots, with maybe the most infamous incident where we saw the PAOK Thessaloniki owner, Ivan Savidis, charging onto the pitch with a gun. And here in England, which it's a bit of an unfortunately long list, there's racism and homophobic incidents at games is becoming alarmingly frequent. The England fans have been at it again through the year in Portugal for the Nations League final, and there were incidents in Spain. There have been numerous clashes between rival fans throughout the year, and a really bewildering weekend where multiple players were actually attacked on the pitch. And then there was what happened in Bulgaria, which, yeah, don't need to expand on much.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, in the intro, Matt, you know, you're 26 years old, and which I just wish I was 26 years old again. And, you know, from what you're saying and from what we're seeing on the screens, etc., I mean, it's almost what, you know, we used to call them the dark days and sort of the 70s and the 80s. And, yes, things have moved on and perhaps things are a little bit more politically motivated now, but it... You know, certainly with the racism, the homophobia, the violence, the hooliganism, it feels like what we thought had perhaps left the game, certainly in this country and across Europe, but it's almost like it's creeping back. It feels like it's this dark shadow that's sort of creeping back across the continent and back across the game of football that we thought had more or less gone and, you know, we'd managed to get rid of. And it just feels like we're turning back time.
I totally agree. And I mean, I can only speak from my point of view now, but... And whether or not maybe I wasn't taking notice a few years ago, but it's not the sort of stuff that you ever noticed. Or you sort of knew it was there in some sort of small part, but you thought it was just a minority. And yeah. these incidents go through the roof, and more happens. And I don't know, you start wondering whether you yourself just wasn't paying attention to it in the past, or whether it is, you know, becoming more frequent. But I think the reality of it is that it was always there, but we maybe just weren't taking notice.
I suppose, I mean, Gary, I'm not asking you a question, but do you, you know, like Matt's mentioned about, you know, was it always there? But obviously, like say, you and I were sort of around in the dark. Do you think it's complacency more than anything else?
That's a good question.
Sorry.
No. I mean, Stu, you've got your reputation nailed it again. Might be an impossible question. I think the short answer is yes. You know. I want to say it's Pericles, and I might be wrong. He said the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Pericles was an ancient Athenian. So I think, you know, the more we take our eye off the ball, no pun intended there, that, you know, these sort of things can creep up on us unannounced. And I think, yeah, complacency could well be the answer there. I don't know what you think, Matthew.
Complacency... Maybe, yeah. Maybe there was an element of thinking things were solved and not realising that the sort of institutions and the sort of foundations of the country the political landscape that it's built on is inherently flawed, which means that these sort of problems never really go away.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is something we're going to talk about later, but this sort of thing isn't linked to education, for example, because we see across the country, it doesn't matter what class you are, what your background is, that all the money in the world can get you the best education, but you can still have these really negative views. So the institutions are from the start, and yeah, I think it's a case of, like you say, taking your eye off, we took our eye off the ball, sorry.
Yeah, do you think there is an intrinsic link there between politics, populist politics particularly, and football?
Not necessarily between populist politics and football, but politics and football, yeah. Because it's like as your podcast is, the reason you have this is because they're inherently linked, and football doesn't exist in a separate. It's not separate from society. It's not its own little thing that is unaffected by what happens in Parliament or what happens in the streets. Everything has a knock-on effect.
Yeah. Stu?
Yeah. I mean, like I say, it seems to be, and this is the wrong word, and it sounds really glib, and I apologise for that, but it's almost like it's come back into fashion, and you wonder whether or not, and again, this is could be a very glib statement, but it's almost that some of these beliefs that we're seeing on the terraces has almost been legitimised by the politics that are in place at the moment, or the politics that seem to be sweeping across Europe, and when it's okay or deemed to be okay politically, or when people are being elected into power on the back of a manifesto that promotes this, then fans on terraces, or some fans, not all fans obviously, some fans on terraces, it almost legitimises what they're doing. And if the leaders of the country or if the leaders of the elected party are promoting this, then it must be okay for us to sort of take it onto the terraces and to bring it into popular culture. But like I say, that's how I seem to be sort of interpreting the situation at the moment as it's coming across. And, you know, again, Matt, you know, you're sort of more of an expert on this. I'm just a casual and keen observer of what's happening.
I wouldn't say expert, but I mean, I actually totally agree with what you said. I think, I mean, when you all you have to do is look at examples such as why is the red paper in the country, and it's the Sun. It's the right wing. It's the kind of right wing paper that spreads. I mean, in my opinion, filth. It's horrible. Some of the stuff that comes out, and it's the most red paper. People believe what they read, and then they see, like you say, like it's almost like back in fashion. It's like, okay, to have these thoughts again, or having these thoughts is the right thing to think. It's the right way to see society. So I don't think it's glib at all. I think it's almost exactly as you say.
It's almost like an unnecessarily spoken word. But the thing about populist politics is it's very popular. And it's because it sort of it offers up a siren call to people that, you know, it's not you, it's those other people. Now, whether that be racist, whether that be homophobic, whether that be of any description whatsoever, it's something that that people can easily take to their hearts and believe, because it's nice to think it's not your fault and the world against you, not because of you, because of all these other guys, these other people. And if you sort of join with us and condemn these other people, send them away, then it will all be okay. And that's a little bit of a reductionist attitude to it, but I'm sure there's a grain of legitimacy in that view. Do you think, Matthew?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think it's very easy to pass the book and to look at problems that we have in society and just point to anyone who isn't like you and say it's your fault. And that's kind of, it's the way society seemingly works.
You mentioned you live in Madrid, Matthew. So I just want to sort of delve into your perhaps personal experience, be it in Madrid or the experience you've had while living over in Spain.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I've always had a really, really keen interest in the political aspects of football, because as we've mentioned, that they're inherently linked. There are, you know, what you see in politics, you see in football. But the reason, the sort of vestiges of this idea for this this topic came from, I am a Birmingham City fan, unfortunately. And I was in Madrid when the second City derby happened in March. And when you're in Madrid, there's not that many places to go watching football. You either have to watch it at home or you go find an Irish pub. So me, I sort of roped in an Australian friend at the time who went to the pub to go and watch it. And it was at the time, I don't know if you guys remember, but at the time it was quite a big second City derby. It was, they don't always matter because usually we don't do that well. Or Villa are quite, you know, usually a lot better than us. But at the time, we were sort of hovering outside the playoffs. We lost a couple in a row, and this was like a quite pivotal game. Villa were on fire. They were in the middle of what would become a 10-15 match unbeaten run. But in the end, the 3 points were irrelevant because of what happened, because of the actions of one Blues fan. And around the 10-minute mark, a fan called Paul Mitchell ran onto the pitch and launched a punch at the back of Jack Grealish's head. Thankfully, Grealish wasn't hurt, and he reacted in the best way possible by putting in a storming performance and scoring the winner, and Villa won 1-0. But maybe the most disappointing thing about it was that the fan was escorted off to applause from some sections of the Tilton, one of the stands. And at the same time this was happening, I'm sat in this Irish pub in Madrid, and there was another group of Brummies, more people from Birmingham, who were a mixture of Blues and Villa fans. And as if to really hammer home the disappointment of the day, they spent the entire day singing anti-IRA songs in an Irish pub when the Six Nations was also won, and they were showing the Ireland game, and they were using really aggressive homophobic language. So it was a really thoroughly depressing day all around. And the only thing I could think about was, why did the guy run onto the pitch? What made him think he could do that? Why were these English fans in another city behaving like the stereotypes the Europeans on the continent expect us to act? And I think, like you said, like you mentioned before, I think it was a sort of, felt like a bit of a return to the dark days of football hooliganism.
Yes,
too. A couple of things there. The Australian mate who you took with you, what was his reaction?
He was like stunned. He was just sort of sat there oh my God, what just happened? How did that happen? And we were just sort of both sat there open mouthed, like watching this play out, and neither of us could really believe what was happening. It was an assault. An assault played out on live TV in a situation where that should never have been possible.
And what did he make to the... Obviously, you mentioned about the fans' reaction in the pub, and I suppose I'm quite interested in, I guess, somebody who would be very much a neutral observer in this. And obviously, unfortunately, you know, for the three of us, we're passionate fans who were brought up on the English game, so we'll always have a perspective and recall of good times and bad times with regards to football. But, you know, so your friend, you know, the whole event, the whole day, what happened on the screens, you know, what happened in Birmingham, what happened in the pub, I'm trying to imagine what he must have made of the entire experience as a whole.
Well, I think the most disappointing thing about it is that I don't think he was surprised.
Right.
As in, I don't think he was surprised by the way that the fellow fans were acting, because unfortunately, despite we've mentioned that like hooliganism isn't necessarily as big a problem as it used to be, English and British people have a bit of a reputation now on the continent. When fans come over, they like cities brace themselves. When Liverpool and Tottenham came over for the Champions League final, there were no major problems. I think there was one horrible incident, but apart from that, there weren't that many problems. But the city in the week before was like bracing itself, ready for this wave of 40,000-50,000 English people coming over, and they were genuinely worried. They roped in more police, and I don't know, like being part of a city that's like almost scared or worried about so many English people coming over was a very strange experience.
I've just got one more question. I'm sorry, Gary. It is, like I say, I find it fascinating. It's quite interesting. You know, you mentioned there about obviously your disappointment because you were a Birmingham City fan, and I suppose it still shows what we need to remember is that it's still a minority, I guess, and you know what we're talking about here is, you know, is within the minority of football fans, but obviously there is this fear that it seems to be increasing rather than decreasing.
Yeah, and I think we kind of have to stop thinking in terms of it's just a minority of fans. I'm not going to be able to word this properly now, but by us still thinking that it's just a minority of fans, it's sort of missing the larger problem, that there's like clearly something wrong in education, the background and the culture of something that means that there are still people that act this way. if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, sorry?
No, go on, Matt. Go.
I was just sort of thinking as I'm talking. And, this fan, for instance, this guy who ran on the pitch, he did not care about what happened to him personally. He would not have done what he did if he didn't think he could either get away with it or if he thought it wouldn't affect him long term. And it didn't. He spent, I think, a month in prison, 2 months in prison, and came back out, no question. He said he came out and it was just, awful that he said it was like the best 2 months of his life when he came out. So thinking of it as just a minority and then targeting the minority doesn't work. It's not working anymore. You sort of have to aim it at the masses, which is, I think, the unfortunate part about it.
It's the thing with fans and coming onto football pitches, and people said, what happened? What would happen if somebody attacked a player when they came on the pitch? Well, that happened. And I suppose the next step is what happens if somebody comes on the pitch with, a knife or something, And what happens when these people sort of think that the political atmosphere gives them some kind of invulnerability, that, it's okay to do that. I'm not saying this is any part of any political doctrine, but there must be something that inspires the belief in people that they can do this and get away with it.
Well, yeah, for me, and I think, like as you mentioned, we've got a general election going on at the minute, and when you see politicians using the language that they do and talking the way that they do about other politicians, about other people in society, it validates people and encourages them to act the way that they do. And we've seen instances of racism from politicians. From like our own Prime Minister at the minute has made some comments that many are deemed racist. If I can find the stats, I know The Guardian reported on the fact that there's been a rise in far-right networks, and it's been attributed to the way that politicians talk in Parliament. So it's like providing an example for people to follow.
It's almost normalising... I won't say bad behaviours. Bad behaviour is not the right word, but it's normalising unacceptable behaviour, perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Stu.
Yeah. It's a great point, Matt. Like you say, it's something we mentioned at the beginning. It's almost the legitimising of behaviour, isn't it? It's that whole, this is what we see, this is what we hear on the television, this is how we hear our politicians, our prime ministers, our presidents, it's how we hear them talking, therefore it gives us a legitimacy to go and do it. And it's almost you mentioned just a second ago, a really good point about the education of the masses, and it's a real sort of dichotomy. Feel like we are talking about educating the masses, and yet we're listening to the people who are running the country, and they're almost sending a different message to what we believe is actually the message that should be sent, and the education that we want to bring to the masses just seems completely at odds with people who are ruling the country.
Yeah, it's totally true. I totally agree. And when we have in September, the founder of the anti-racism charity Hope Not Hate, Nick Lawler, he came out to encourage politicians to stop talking in a way that normalises far-right terror, which is an absolutely extraordinary thing for a charity to come out and say about politicians in power who run our country. And it sets an example. It validates people's opinions that they maybe have been hiding or felt that they couldn't have said before now. And I think the best word to describe this is emboldening.
Yeah.
And it encourages the worst of society. And
Yeah. I think when you say it was a sort of extraordinary thing to come out and say, it's probably an extraordinary thing to have to come out and say, or to feel that they have to come out and say, because, as you mentioned, certain political prominent figures, shall we say, have expressed opinions about people from other parts of the world that the vast majority of people find abominable, abominable. And it's almost become, you know, as we were talking earlier, becoming normalising that otherness of people that sort of feeds into this populist politics where people standing on football grounds are encouraged to, well, perhaps passively encouraged to exhibit racist, homophobic attitudes to players that would be utterly unacceptable in normal day life outside of the football arena.
Yeah, it's totally true. And I mean, in certain cases, I know in Italy, for example, the ultras we've mentioned that there's been a lot of incidents and a lot of incidents lately of ultras being horrifically racist against black players. But they don't see it as racism. They see it as like jibes and sort of like taunting the opposition, and just like they think you can do anything possible to put off the opposition to give their team an advantage. And that sort of speaks to such a like something broken in the society that they think that that's acceptable and they think that's okay that they can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we'll get more into this in terms of, you know, where do we go from here, and, you know, and how does this progress, and what will the game look like. But I think with regards to what's happening in Italy, and obviously, you know, there was Balotelli, wasn't it, not a couple of weeks ago, who just picked up the ball and just kicked it into the crowd and walked off. And I mean, you know, we talked about and we built up these statements of what if, you know, and Gary just mentioned them earlier, what if, you know, and we get to the stage of, well, what if players walk off, what if teams walk off, and it seems like it's almost got to the stage where the fans or the far right support who do this and implement this, that's what they're after. They're almost goading the fans to go further, or goading the players to sort of, well, go on then, you know, walk off then, you know. And it's almost brinkmanship between teams and players and the fans, if you like.
I agree, and I think it highlights how UEFA and FIFA and the sanctions and the protocols we've heard so much about, and in my opinion, they've got that wrong. We saw in Bulgaria with what happened there with the England game, that when they stopped the game and when the Tannoy announcement went out, it was like encouragement. It was like you say, it was like a dare. It was like, go on then, what are you going to do next? And it just got worse. So, and then if the authorities have these sanctions and then don't carry them out and don't enact them with any purpose, then it's all, you know, it's false, and players aren't being protected.
Yeah, it's interesting. Brought to the Bulgaria game, and you know, English fans shouldn't get too uppity about this because there's a lot of racism in English football as well. But I know. After the game, there's a lot of newspapers came out with, oh, 6-0, that's the best way to beat racism. No, it isn't. No, it isn't. You could score 28 goals and it doesn't solve the problem. It's not the answer. And, you know, the people who go and I would say, watch football there, those racist fans, it's the attitude that's wrong. It's not a matter of you're gonna sort of, you know, fine them €20,000 or even ban them for 3 games or close the stadium for 4 games. That's not the answer. The answer's a lot deeper. It's in the psyche of the community, it's in the psyche of the society that they live in. And I'll say, I really want to sort of emphasise that I'm not sort of picking on Bulgaria particularly, because there's a massive amount of racism, homophobia and other distaste for otherness in the UK as well. What's your thoughts on that, Matthew?
I totally agree. And you're right to point. Gareth Southgate said, it's like there were horrible incidents happening on the continent, but also you've got to get our house in order first. And it all relates back to the sort of culture and the foundation that the society is sort of built on. And when we have, like, you look at our parliament, you look at the heads of big businesses, it's always the same. It's all sort of old, straight white men. And that doesn't allow a society. It's not representative of society.
When you say straight white men, I mean, what it is openly straight white men. So it might be white men who aren't straight, but necessarily are sort of ashamed or begrudging to declare their sexuality. I mean, I don't know that, but I'm just saying it's that sort of perception reality situation.
Yeah,
Stu?
Yeah, I think Matt's brought up a great point there about this representation of society. And, you know, you only have to look at maybe governing bodies, if you like, and you look at the very, very top of the governing bodies, you know, within football, and you look at the demographics that make up, you know, these positions of authority and position responsibility and positions whereby they are making decisions. And, you know, I mean, Les Ferdinand, you know, has been a wonderful spokesperson about the lack of opportunity for black coaches or for black people at boardroom level in football clubs. And while we are here talking about, you know, populist politics and the impact that goes there, you know, and what we've mentioned about how, you know, popular politics is legitimising what's going on the terraces, but you also have this legitimisation, and I'm loath to be critical of the FA, and this is, you know, I'm not trying to be, you know, saying the FA doesn't do anything, but you look at how governing bodies are made up within football authorities, and there is again this replication of straight white males, and it's just not a representation of football in any of the countries that we're talking about, in any of the leagues, even at grassroots level, it's not a representation of the game.
I totally agree with what you're saying, and it's just vitally important that places like not to pick on the FA, like you say, but that there is more diversification and more representation of society, and it's pretty much one of the only ways that society can move forward and, like, you know, get past these horrible incidents.
Yeah, we're talking a fair bit about where we are, but I guess the question with where you are is sort of, you know, how do we get here? So what do you think is the history? If I asked you how did we get into the situation with political populism and football and racism, homophobia, and any sort of otherness that people want to sort of chuck into the pot, where do you sort of think this is sort of been driven by?
Well, this is where it does get a bit complicated, because I mean, we mentioned a lot of incidents earlier in Italy, France. I mean, they're all linked, but they each have their own individual background. So France, for example, the homophobic chanting that was taking place during games was a tactic used by frustrated ultra fans in defiance at the LFP, and in response to the French government in reaction to what they saw as extreme measures taken against football fans. And this was all in the wake of numerous terror attacks. And these restrictions included crackdowns on flares and smoke bombs, and specifically on away fans as well. So, yeah, football has always acted as a reflection of society. As I mentioned, it's not its own private room. It's not unaffected by what happens. And over the last 10 years, we've seen the sort of rise of populism and far-right politics. So much so that the populist parties have tripled in votes over the last 20 years, are now in government in 11 countries in Europe. And the Guardian, who coordinated research into this, found that one in four Europeans are now voting for populist parties. In 1998, there were 12.5 million people living under populist governments, and now that number is 170 million. So it's not difficult to see how this, you know, this translates over into what we see in football stadiums.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you'll be aware that, you know, here in Spain, the rise of Vox is a massively worrying trend. You raise excellent points there, and obviously the perceived political dominance, sort of speaks to people in ways that seduces their prejudices and encourages their prejudices.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, when we talk about populism, it can be difficult to define exactly what it is. But it's funny you should mention Vox. This comes from Vox EU, which is a research and political analytics platform, nothing to do with the Spanish party. But they believe that there are four main causes for populist politics. First is the economic roots, which include stagnating incomes, unemployment, and personal and regional inequalities. Then there's cultural roots, which is the increasing dominance of liberal values. Then comes the fear and uncertainty, something that is a consequence of a quick change. And a good example of this is the Great Recession in 2008. And then there's policy failures. If those who cause this fear and uncertainty mentioned aren't punished, or if those who are affected aren't compensated, it can cause frustration and anger. And it's not difficult to look at many of these root causes and see numerous examples of them over the past decade. You've got the recession, you've got the Wall Street crash, you've got the refugee crisis, and those are just global examples. In France is a really good example of this. After the World Cup in 1998, where the multicultural French team, which was seen as such a success in more than just footballing terms, thanks to the sort of terror attacks and the French government's, or what many see as not a good enough reaction, it's just as divided a country as Britain supposedly is. And yeah, I mean, it's not difficult to sort of hyper-focus on some of the roots just mentioned and see parallels with Britain.
Yeah. You mentioned the French World Cup. I've been watching on Netflix the programme Le Bleu, which does a focus on that multicultural French team that won the World Cup, and the options is open for healing of sort of past wounds. And it strikes me that there was an echo of that with Wijnaldum and Holland. The midweek internationals, where after he scored, he was captain of the Dutch national team, and he walked in front of the cameras by the dugouts and held a hand, so his arm was next to, I think it was Frankie de Jong, so there's a black and white holding hands. Now, I mean, that might be sort of like, seem like a small, significant step, but football is actually, can heal these wounds, can sort of pour a little balm on the problems of that society has with regards to this. I mean, do you think, Matthew?
I do. I think you only have to look at like stuff like World Cups and see how many people are interested in how it can bring so many people, millions of people around the world together and into one place where people enjoy the same thing. And yeah, I think it's vastly important. I mean, football clubs especially have always been pillars of community. They've always been something that people come from all over the city, come to together on a day, and they're together. They're part of the same tribe, for want of a better word. And they're all together with the same belief and the same interest. So it's even in today's society where, I mean, as we mentioned, things seem, feel very divided, it's still something that brings people together.
Yeah. Dave?
Everything you're saying, it's fascinating. Like I say, Matt, these sort of topics are, you know, I think they're fantastic. I think they need to be spoken about. And I suppose I just want to, the numbers that you gave and the statistics that you gave about populist governments was incredible. And I wonder, I suppose I'm asking your opinion really on this, as to whether what now seems to be almost a perceived lack of challenge to the populist governments, or the gaining strength and the gaining control and power of populist governments. Do you think that's what we're seeing replicated in the terraces in terms of there seems to be a decreasing lack of challenge on racist behaviour, on homophobic behaviour, on the violence? You know, you mentioned the word embolden, which, you know, it was a great word. And it just seems to me like the lack of challenge at political level is almost replicated again on the terraces, this lack of real challenge for what's happening.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I know in terms of like in political terms, so populism is all about creating the concept of the other. It's all about creating an opposition, causing division, which is usually between the people who are positioned in opposition to the elite. And this is a kind of interesting thing where populism isn't left or right leaning. It's more of a stance, a tactic used to pit these people against the ruling class. And I need to remember exactly where I read this, but a lot of the really successful politicians who use this are the right-wing politicians, and unfortunately, such as Donald Trump or Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines, Viktor Orban in Hungary. And part of the tactics is attacking liberal values. It's like a reaction to that. And it was really curiously, it was really written as in like bad manners. So it's all about people, these people come out and attack these liberal values. So it's like they're on the attack straight away. And I guess seeing that sort of thing in person as well, like maybe if you're in a stadium and you see people doing that, I mean, I've personally never seen something like that, and you'd like to think that you would always say something, but I guess it must be difficult to be in that scenario.
Yeah, there's a sort of eternal, quality is the last word I'm looking for, eternal ethos about populist politics that they have. They concentrate on convincing poor people to blame other poor people for their lack of social progress. So working-class people, who tend to be people who go to football games, are encouraged to blame other people, the other disadvantaged people, be they sort of immigrant people or non-white people. I'm talking about the UK particularly, so black footballers particularly, or Asian footballers. So identify them as the enemy who are causing the problem, when really, you know, the people who are causing the problem are the people who are actually trying to convince you that it's somebody else who are causing the problems. You know, the populist politics is very much blame others of a similar ilk rather than blame us. It's not me, it's those other guys who are similar like you.
It's the tactics that they use, because it's about, like you say, it's a blame game. It's about pointing at other people and saying this is where you direct your anger. And the way society works is that there always needs to be a bottom rung on the ladder for people to be, and unfortunately, this is usually people like immigrants, like gay people, like anything other than white people, I guess, because that's the way that, especially in Britain, the society has always been built that way. It's always been geared towards a certain class of society, I guess. I don't know if I worded that right, but
no, it's fine. Yes,
too. Yeah, I mean, like I say, I suppose the other question here is, you know, we talk about, you know, the lack of challenge at political level, and obviously, Gary, you mentioned, you mentioned the incident with Wijnaldum a couple of nights ago, and I suppose I'll ask both of you this question, to be honest, and, you know, does football have the power, have it within itself to actually heal from within, or is it going to need support? I mean, politics, you know, if we look at politics in this country at the moment, to me, it just seems just broken. It just seems like it's completely broken down and seems to require external help and support, and I don't know how or where that's going to come from. And from a football perspective, you know, can football heal itself, which is what it may well have to do?
Matthew?
I think this is a bit of a depressing answer, but I don't think so.
I kind of agree. Because, I agree.
and I think the problem with this is that as much as we love football and we love going, it's very easy to forget that football isn't just a sport. It's run by businessmen. It's run by the same sort of people who run the country, is run by the same ilk of politicians and people in power. And if they are so seemingly unwilling to catch up with the times, I guess, and see that the way things are working isn't working, then it needs a whole culture shift. It needs a whole culture shift in society before a certain section of society can fix itself.
Yeah, that's a great answer, Matthew. And I agree 100%. And, you know, picking up on Stu's point there, you know, I think with the general election coming up in the UK, it's people are more concerned about who not to vote for than who to vote for. It's not who they want, it's who they want out. And is there any way in which you think football's impacted back against this sort of populist politics? Is it, can football heal these wounds? When we spoke about earlier about Wijnaldum and Frankie de Jong, but are there other ways where, I mean, FIFA has this thing about, I can't think of games for all, or we're all the same on the pitch. Before international games, they have players standing in a mixed area before kick-off, with, you know, where teams are intermingling. But does it really make a difference? Is it just showyism, for want of a better word?
I think I'm going to make this is going to be a bit hypocritical now, but I find FIFA quite disingenuous when it comes to this sort of stuff. I mean, was it last year that they disbanded the racism task force?
Yeah.
Sort of citing that it's been solved. which was, extraordinary. But
Well done, FIFA. Well done, UEFA, FIFA. Well done, guys.
Problem solved, we can go home. I actually think, as much as I said that football can't solve, it will play a part. And I think there are some really good examples of that, like of football clubs that are very political. And I know, for example, there was a really good article recently in The Guardian about Bahia in Brazil, who are becoming increasingly political in their community outreach and what they do on the pitch. They recently wore football shirts with oil designs on them to protest the hundreds of tons of thick crude oil that had been washing up on the beaches of northeast Brazil. They consistently run campaigns on issues like racism, LGBTQ rights, the demarcation of indigenous lands, and how female fans are treated in the stadiums. And then a bit closer to home, there's the example of São Paulo, who I think are probably the most political football club in the world. In 2009, the board, along with a few hundred fan representatives, put together club guidelines that reflected their political stance. And it's a really fascinating read. It has all sorts of stuff ranging from the social responsibility of the football club, tolerance and respect for others, and the regulation of sponsorship deals and business partners. And these clubs, they set out these manifestos, they set out these political stances, and they stick to it. I mean, I think it happened about a month ago, but São Paulo sacked one of their midfielders, Cenk Sahin, because he was part of the Turkish team who celebrated goals by performing military salutes, and posted on his Instagram, and I quote, "We're on the side of our heroic military and armies. Our prayers are with you as Turkey invaded Syria."
Yeah.
Which unbelievable, really. And São Paulo sacked him, saying that after numerous discussions with fans, members and friends whose roots lie in Turkey, it has become clear to us that we cannot and should not attempt to gouge nuances in perceptions and attitudes from other cultural backgrounds in detail. That we reject acts of war is not open to doubt or discussion, however. These acts and the expression of solidarity with them run counter to the values of the club. And they sacked him. And they stuck to their political stance, stuck to their beliefs. And I think as populism and far-right politics grows, clubs will become a bit more political, and they're going to be forced to become more political.
Yeah,
I mean, like I say, we could talk about this forever, for all night. I suppose a question, Matt, is how do you see the clubs that, you know, we've talked briefly about ultras, and if you think about the control that certain clubs or that certain factions of ultras have over a club, do you think there's any way whereby, I'm not saying control can be wrestled away from them, because, you know, the how much control is very ambiguous, and we probably don't know where the real power lies in certain clubs. But obviously, if you have a large section of ultra that are very, very dominant within your club, and their ethos is of far right, will a club ever be able to shed that sort of image or that persona for as long as those ultras are involved within the club?
I think this is very much sort of dependent on the club. Because I know I'm going to get this wrong now, but I think it's River Plate who their ultras sort of is they're called the Barra Bravas, something like that. Their ultras are so ingrained in the club that they are like almost political forces, and members of that ultras have gone on to be prime ministers or president in Argentina, in the country. So in instances like that, I think possibly not, because the families that are involved will raise their children to be just like them. And it's like a culture. It's the culture that they're built on means that it doesn't allow them to stray from that. Yeah. In other countries, I'm not so sure. I think maybe in places like Germany, I think it's possible, because they're not as aggressive in the way that they act like other countries. But in some instances like Italy, I think it's a lot more difficult. Mm. I think there'd be a lot of pushback. And I know in Italy, for example, they have the ultras. They hate other ultras, and yet they have mutual respect for ultra culture, don't they? I'm going to get this wrong, but when the recent incident with Mario Balotelli, Brescia fans came out, Brescia Ultra, sorry, came out to stand with Verona Ultras, which was mind-boggling. So in instances like that, I think not. It would take a long time.
Yeah. I'm going to sort of invoke the B word here. Not so long ago, a few days ago, a particular politician, we shouldn't remain nameless, said how Brexit would benefit English football by encouraging more English players to come through and limiting foreign inputs of players. Now, I mean, obviously this is a sort of populist politics way of seeking support from football fans for their view. I mean, I'm trying to disguise my view about Brexit here, but I'm probably failing miserably. But do you think this is sort of an example of how populist politics can sort of use football as a political tool?
Yeah, I'm not sure this is so central. What's what I'm looking for? So just. Related to populist politics, because if I remember right, Tony Blair was very big on using football as a sort of tool for getting more supporters, wasn't he?
Well, he did say he remembered sitting in the on the Gallagate end as a child, but there were no seats at the Gallagate end when he was a child. So that was a pretty forlorn effort to ingratiate Newcastle fans and football fans into his belief. But I can't remember the guy's name who said this, but it was certainly an attempt to convince football fans that Brexit is a good thing. You know, I'm going to think of thumbs up here, just in sort of mock approval of this ridiculous stance.
It's not something that makes sense to me exactly, but it's just another way that football is used as a political tool. It's a way of convincing certain supporters in the country who I think will be supporting him already. It's an emboldening again. It's revalidating their stance.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You're absolutely right, Matthew. Stu?
Yeah, I think when we talk about politicians and using, you know, and Gary and I, we've practically done four series, which ultimately comes down to politicians, politics, and football, and how those three are interlinked and entwined. And I think when politicians are involving themselves in the game for personal gain or for political gain outside of the game, that's quite a complicated sentence, I'm sorry. There's always going to be an issue, and football seems to be almost not unable to defend itself, but it's sort of always going to be, because we, you know, it's so popular and it attracts so many people, and it attracts a demographic who will have a say in who runs the country. It's always going to be a bargaining chip, if you like, for these politicians to use. It's always going to be an area that they're going to try and perhaps infiltrate, or perhaps try to I suppose, try to align themselves with or create some sort of allegiance with to prove to the voting masses that, you know, that they are on their side, if you like. Because, you know, and as we've talked about before, some people, their life revolves around the game of football and that, like, every Saturday afternoon or that fortnightly trip every Saturday afternoon. Now, if there's somebody there who is promising to make it better, promising to make it more accessible, promising to, you know, to make the game safer, better, whatever it is, then, you know, that's a that can very much be a vote-winning manifesto or a vote-winning pledge. But going back, football just seems so open and so susceptible to the... It almost has no defence mechanism. There's no defence barrier for football. It's just laid there, laid open, laid bare for politicians to exploit. I mean, I don't know what you think, Matt. That's just my particular rant.
No, I agree. I think football has always been like a mirror to society. It's like a playground where... where like speech leaders and politicians, what they do is sort of mirrored. I mean, there's a really perfect example of this in Portugal. The former chairman of Sporting Lisbon, Bruno de Carvalho, he was described as the populist chairman because he was very outspoken in a similar vein to Donald Trump. There was lots of talk about making Sporting great again, but when he was expelled early this year, the club was at war with itself and facing financial problems. He was blamed for inciting fan fury with his criticism of the underperforming players. He described them as spoiled, stalky kids after they lost to Atletico Madrid in the Champions League. And then I'm sure we all remember this, but he was allegedly behind the violent attacks by Sporting supporters on the players and managers at the training facilities.
He was
later detained by the police for a whopping total of 56 crimes, including terrorism, kidnapping, and prohibited gun possession. And there's a really great quote from him where he says, "They call me a populist. They say I'm an unethical demagogue. Well, I'll tell them something. If you're not with sport, then you're all shitheads." Which sounds very similar to certain other politicians. It's like society's hyper focused in football.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. It's everything that happens in society happens times 10 in football.
So where we are now, it sounds like a not exactly ideal place. So get your crystal ball out, Matthew. Just dust it off. Let's look at Mystic Matthew. And say, let's have a look 10 years into the future. So in your opinion, what are the good and the worst things that could happen with football and football with regard to populist politics?
So I'll start with the worst things because, you know, we can finish on something positive. the worst things, I think we'll see more of the sort of the hate crimes and the racism and the homophobic incidents happen until, you know, something really awful happens. Rich clubs will continue to get richer. The divide will just explode, and how Brexit affects football is a whole other thing, and I think that could fill a whole series of podcasts. I think the way it affects football is it gets worse. I think we see more incidents, like we see more examples of the Sporting Lisbon chairman, more outspoken, more populist-esque politicians or businessmen getting involved in football. But then the flip side of it, the good, I think, like I mentioned, Bahia and Sport and Sinhali, sorry, I think we could see more examples of clubs like that. And not necessarily always out of choice. I mean, I think this brings me kind of nicely back around to Birmingham City. One of the reasons why other fans of Birmingham were so upset that this incident happened in the second city derby was because it totally overshadowed what had been a really good season off the pitch. There were lots of community outreach, lots of inviting terminally ill fans into the club to give them something to, you know, days off from what they were suffering from. Lots of stuff to do with one of our former strikers, Jeff Horsfield, set up a homeless charity, and that was made the official charity of the club. There was lots of instances of players and staff members going to the homeless shelters and to feed the homeless on certain nights of the week. Some of this, as we've seen in places like Newcastle and Liverpool, where there's lots of food banks, is forced. Like, clubs have to get involved to sort of help out in the community. But I think that's something we could see more of, more openly political and more community outreach stuff by clubs.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously the future's there for us to decide, and we're all sort of part of the future when we make this. And you know, I guess the politics, much like football, is tends to be a wheel, and things change as it, you know, as they go forward. And can football make a difference? Can football change these things? We talk about, you know, how will populist politics affect football. You know, can football, a bit like the Ronaldo thing, can football make a difference?
I think it can to a point. I think this is the depressing ending to the podcast, I think. But I think it can to a point, but only so far, because football is a part of society, whether people like it or not. You know, you always get these people that say keep football away from politics, politics away from football, but that's so inherently linked that they sort of bounce off each other, and the effect is intrinsic. So football can have an effect and can bring people together in the same place with the same beliefs, and direct that into positive energy, I suppose, but only to a certain point, because it needs society to catch up or society to lead. And the sort of the foundation and the culture that society is currently built on is not up to scratch.
Yeah, Stu?
Yeah, it's a really depressing ending to the podcast. I agree, man. I think, you know, you mentioned right at the start about education and you know, I mean, that's so important, so important, you know. And sometimes, you know, you talk about lost generations, and really, you know, we're looking at the children now, you know, the sort of 7, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds, you know, almost that's where the education now needs to start. And if you think about how long that will take to filter through, you know, we've probably lost a generation already who've been brought up with this populist politics and within this environment that's currently, you know, we talk about America and Donald Trump and, you know, across Europe. I think, you know, I think we need to, the education is right, but it's going to take time for that to filter through. I think with regards to football, for me, I think football needs to be braver and be brave. And I know it's easy for me sat here to say what football as an entity should and shouldn't be, but I think I would just like to see it to be braver. I would like clubs to be braver. I would like to see players being that little bit braver to actually challenge what is happening and be a part of the education process, not just be passive and wait for education to infiltrate into the grounds and infiltrate into the game, but actually, you know, be a part of the education, be a part of changing what is happening. And it's not football's responsibility. Matt's absolutely right. It's everybody's responsibility. But I think for me, I would just like to see football be a little bit braver with what it does and what it says, and stand up for itself perhaps a little bit more.
I actually totally agree. I think the bravery is a really good point. If England had walked off the pitch in Bulgaria and just finished the game there and then, I think that would have made an incredible statement, and yeah, it would have been something that, I mean, obviously the media took notice, and there were, like, The Guardian did a really, really fantastic special podcast about it. But if they'd have walked off the pitch, it would have forced change. It would have forced governments and the authorities to really take notice and, yeah, like you say, force change upon them.
Yeah.
It's a great answer, Matthew, and you know, we're almost echoing the situation that, you know, if you're not part of the solution, then you are part of the problem.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, yeah, I think we'd all agree with that. We would close the same question, Matthew, so I'm going to sort of pose this to you now. This has been a really fascinating discussion, you know, about a really contemporary issue that impinges on not only football, but also on society as well. But so the question is this: so can football exist in a political vacuum? does the passion engendered by the game too easily lend itself to being a political tool? So in short, is political football inevitable?
Political football is inevitable. It always has been inevitable and always will be. There is no separating football from politics, in my opinion. It's too much a centre of society. It's always been the working class sport where people from all over the city come to vent and express themselves and to get away from, you know, a shitty week at work or what happens in politics. It doesn't exist, like I've said numerous times now in this podcast, but it doesn't exist outside of society. An absolute central part of it. It's like a big community aspect of it, and there's no separating football from politics, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, of all the people we've had on the episodes that we've done to date, I don't know, there are 25, 30 or so, you know, you're sort of echoing the vast majority of opinions there, you know, and I don't dissent from that. I don't know if we still agree with that, but I think you probably would. Massive, massive thanks, Matthew. That's been a fantastic discussion on a really difficult subject and something that we all should focus on in this time.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me on. It's been fascinating.
Great. Any final thoughts, Stu?
No, I mean, like I say, I don't love the subject matter. I do love discussing the topic. Matt's given some great points that I'd not thought of, perspectives that I've not seen things from. And, you know, like I say, this is why I beg, borrow and steal any opportunity to be on these, Gary, because you always are. We always pick up something new. And, you know, this has been no different, but because it's so immediate, you know, we've talked about football in Brazil, we've talked about it in, you know, we've talked about it all around the world, but, you know, but this one is so close, you know, it's so close and so real and so current and so contemporary. It's been brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
I couldn't agree more, mate. And, you know, as we say many, many, many times on these podcasts, you know, every one of these is a school day for us, mate. And thanks, Matthew. It's been great discussing this with you. This has been the Political Football, and today we've been discussing populist politics and how it affects football, how football might affect populist politics as well. So thank you for listening, and catch us next time on the Political Football. Thank you, and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.